Thank you. Okay. So, first of all, thank you for inviting me over here. Nice to see you all here today. You always invariably always hear about the Buddhist site of Victoria, because I understand it is the oldest Buddhist site in Australia. Is that right, Cora? Yeah.
That is correct.
Yeah, that's right. So, started back in 1950.
I think we're the second oldest technically, but they're all still operating as a Buddhist center. The Sydney one's a library. It was a little bit older.
Okay. It's good to be here. So this is where Buddhism pretty much started in Australia. It's very auspiciously and very nice. And it's also wonderful that now you are moving on towards establishing a forest monastery. Yeah. The Buddha said many beautiful things about living in the forest, about the Sangha living in the forest in particular. And in the Mahaparinibbana Sutra, the Buddha says quite specifically that if the monastic Sangha lives in the forest, and practice in the forest, then you can expect that Buddhism will last for a long time into the future. This idea of forest dwelling, living away from the city, is an integral part of the Buddhist practice. And without that, you can actually expect the decline of Buddhism without that. So it's a wonderful thing that you're moving that direction. You're moving towards the sustaining of Buddhism for the long term in the future by doing this. It's a great thing. We already have it very well established in Perth. It's funny isn't how Perth is kind of this minor city on the fringe of Australia, whereas Melbourne is more kind of the center of things. But sometimes that's the way it goes. So now it's wonderful to see you going in the same direction. So for today's Dhamma talk, I'm going to read some suttas for you. I'm not going to really read them. I'm going to talk about some suttas. I'm going to read a little bit and explain these things. And the reason I want to do that is that I always regard understanding the word of the Buddha very fundamental for anyone who is a Buddhist. This is where, at the end of the day, we should draw our inspiration in the word of the Buddha. This is where, if you have any conflict and a lack of understanding, you find maybe two teachers saying opposite things. If you want to resolve anything, if you want to understand what Buddhism is all about, this is where you have to go. And sometimes people think that the sutta, so scary, I can't understand what it is there, it's too difficult, maybe I have to learn Pali first, all these kind of things. But actually the reality is, it's not that scary at all. The suttas are quite accessible, even for ordinary people. Sometimes you read a sutta, it's like it speaks to you directly, right? It's almost, the Buddha existed 2,500 years ago, a different culture, different time, and still, even though that is the case, still this sutta speaks directly to us. And that is the genius of the Buddha, that's the power of the Buddha. He speaks across time, across culture, because he speaks to the human condition. It doesn't matter what background you have, it doesn't matter what era of his history you come from. He speaks what it means to be human. And because he speaks to that, it is possible for us to relate to these teachings directly in the present day. And so these things are very powerful for that reason. And one of the things that always occurs to me as well about the suttas is that the Buddha must have got it right. Right? If the Buddha didn't have it right, if he got it wrong, well, that's the hope for the rest of us. Then the whole of Buddhism kind of collapses like a house of cards. Because all of Buddhism, the whole history of Buddhism, is built on the foundation that the Buddha had an insight into reality, an understanding of what things are actually like. Yeah. That is what the whole thing is built up on. So if the Buddha got it wrong, it means that the rest isn't that interesting. So the assumption of Buddhism is always that the Buddha had it right. And because he had it right, it's very useful to go back to his teachings. Sometimes you may have doubts whether any particular monk or nun has got it right. I sit up here. Most of you have probably never seen me before. You wonder, who is this fellow coming from Perth, And fair enough, maybe you should think like that. That's a good way of thinking. You should always be a little bit, not skeptical, but you should be kind of, you shouldn't have your kind of stupid kind of faith just because someone is a monk or whatever. It's good to listen, and then if it matches with the word of the Buddha, good. If it doesn't, well then you should always, at the end of the day, rely on the word of the Buddha as your refuge. That is the triple refuge, what it's all about. So let us have a look at some of these suttas that I picked for today. And the first one is actually about this particular topic, why it is so important to listen to the word of the Buddha. That's what the first sutta is about. It's a pretty short little thing. Now I'll just read it out for you, and then I will explain what is happening here. So this is just without speaking to the monks, because there are at least five future perils as yet unarisen that will arise in the future. We should recognize them and make an effort to abandon them. What are these five? So I will take one of these five. This is number four. And the Buddha says, because in the future there will be monks who are undeveloped in body, undeveloped in virtuous behavior, undeveloped in mind, and undeveloped in wisdom. Doesn't sound very good, does it? When those discourses spoken by the Tathagata are being recited that are deep, deep in meaning, world transcending, connected with emptiness, they will not want to listen to them, lend an ear to them, or apply their minds to understand them. They will not think those teachings should be studied and learned. But when those discourses are being recited that are mere poetry, composed by poets, beautiful in words and phrases, created by outsiders, spoken by disciples, they will want to listen to them, lend an ear to them, apply their minds to understand them, and they will think those teachings should be studied and learned. Thus, because through defilement of the Dhamma comes defilement of the discipline, and from defilement of the discipline comes defilement of the Dhamma. Thus is the fourth peril in the future, as yet unarisen, that will arise in the future. You should recognize it and make an effort to abandon it. So here you can see the Buddha makes a distinction between the teachings of the Buddha and the teachings of someone who is not. And the teaching of the Buddha have all these special qualities, right? And this is what makes them so interesting. And whereas the other people who are listed here, you are at a certain degree of uncertainty about these teachings. So you see here the sort of things that he says, the teaching discourses that are mere poetry composed by poets, beautiful in words and phrases, right? And this is a tendency of the human mind. We tend to like things that are beautiful, tend to like things that sound right, things that kind of are, because this is the human mind, we move towards the beautiful things of the world, towards sensuality basically, towards things that are attractive. But that is not necessarily where you find the deepest meaning, right? The purpose of the Buddhist teachings is actually to have a deep meaning. And this is what it says here at the beginning, teachings that are deep and deep in meaning. Sometimes things can seem deep on the surface. You think, wow, that is profound, right? Like some of these sayings that people come up with, a famous Indian guru who turned out to be a bit of a scallywag later on, Rajneesh, right? He said something, I'm so detached, I'm not even attached to detachment, or something like that. And it sounds really kind of, when you hear it, it sounds, wow, this is really profound, right? But is it really profound, or is it just kind of a clever wording? And to think about it, it really is just a clever wording, and it isn't really very profound. But the teachings of the Buddha, not only are they deep, but they appear deep, but they are deep. They have a deep meaning. There's something beautiful there. And that is why they need to be investigated and looked at. And I will look at that afterwards. And this is the difference between something which is beautiful on the surface and something which is truly beautiful. Because the message underneath is powerful and beautiful. That is a beautiful thing. A message which is truly beautiful is a message which has the ability to transform you, right? To make you a better person, to make you have less suffering in life, to have more happiness in life. This is a truly beautiful message. And this is what we're talking about. We're talking about the teachings of the Buddha. So, this is the first thing about his teachings. They are deep and deep in meaning, world transcending, right? This is the thing which makes you kind of, it makes you so content and so happy eventually as you practice this path. It's a gradual movement upwards. It makes you so content that eventually it's like you leave this world behind. And by this world, we mean the human realm, where there is a lot of suffering, there's lots of problems, there's all kind of issues that we always have to deal with. You leave all these problems behind and you move into a state of purity and great satisfaction and contentment and fulfillment. This is the thing that we are really yearning for, isn't it? Fulfillment. Feeling complete inside. Not feeling this lack which is always there. If you ask yourself what crediting is all about, crediting is a sense of emptiness inside. It's like a hole that needs to be filled, right? And crediting said, if you run after this, if you follow after this, if you get this, whatever it is, then that hole inside of you, this feeling of emptiness inside of you, will be filled up. But that is the promise of crediting. That's what it's kind of pushing you to do. But actually, it doesn't work. You run after the thing, and then you get it, and then you find the hole is still there, and you crave more, right? And your crediting too says, if you get me, then you will be happy. So we do it again. And still, it is there, right? And we do this again and again and again. And eventually, if we have a bit of wisdom, particularly with the help of the Buddha's teachings, we realize that this hole, this craving inside of us, cannot be filled by simply getting the object of that craving. That object is never going to fulfill us. We have to fulfill us. We have to get the sense of completeness inside in a different way. And what is that way? That is the Buddhist path is all about. When you practice the Buddhist path, gradually, you grow in contentment, you grow in happiness, suffering goes down, you crave less for the world because you have more happiness inside of you. More happiness only means less desire externally because you're already fulfilled, right? And then gradually you feel a sense of fulfillment inside. And this degree of fulfillment increases, until craving kind of drops down at the same time. One goes up, craving goes down. And as this happens, you start to feel fulfilled inside. And you start to feel that the purpose of life is being fulfilled there. You're actually reaching that sense of, wow, this is it. The meaning of life is starting to become apparent to you. And you're actually reaching that meaning of life. What a beautiful thing that is. This is what it means, world transcending. You go beyond this world of craving and desires to a sense of fulfillment in a much higher state of mind, which is what it's all about. That's a wonderful message. That's a beautiful message. Feeling fulfilled, feeling complete. It's such a, when you think about that, it's, wow, this is all I'm really after in life. This is what life is all about. And now I'm getting it fulfilled. So world transcending, connected with emptiness. And this is the idea, of course, the Buddhist idea of non-self, right? It's connected with emptiness. And when you read the suttas, the Buddha will always say that there is one thing that distinguishes the Buddhist teaching from all other teachings in the world, that is this idea of non-self. In Buddhism, we have this idea of non-self. Nothing else, no other teachings really have this idea of non-self in quite the same way as the Buddhist teaching. So the Buddha actually teaches this emptiness, and that's what you find in the suttas. And this emptiness is then one of the highest teachings of Buddhism. It's good to know that sometimes the idea of emptiness is glorified into some kind of very special teaching. But the idea of emptiness, is certainly in early Buddhism and the suttas, just means that the lack of a self, the lack of a permanent entity inside, that's essentially what it means. That's what we find in the Buddha's teachings. And instead of being interested in that, right, if you don't understand, well, this is why I'm trying to bring these things out and show you how profound these things are. Because sometimes you read the teachings of the Buddha and you don't get this kind of thing. And because you don't get it, you think, yeah, whatever, you know, I'd rather read some poetry or whatever. And this is what the Buddha says afterwards. You read the poetry, beautiful words and phrases, that which is created by outsiders. And sometimes we find that even Buddhist people, they find more inspiration in teaching that are outside of Buddhism rather than in the beautiful word of the Buddha. I've seen that among monastics. Some monastics kind of read all kinds of stuff, and they don't, sometimes they kind of lose interest in the word of the Buddha. And of course, you can see where that is heading. That is heading eventually you end up disrobing because you're not really feeling like a Buddhist anymore. So the outsiders, from a Buddhist point of view, and I think that is my experience, that the Buddha's teaching is something special about that, that I can relate to. It's very difficult to find elsewhere. And then lastly, the most interesting thing here to me is this idea spoken by disciples, right? How people tend to elevate the speeches of disciples. Disciples means all of us here, right? Including the monks and the nuns and every one of us. Elevate the teachings of the disciples often above the word of the Buddha. One of the fascinating things I always find is that when you look around the world and you ask people, who is your teacher in Buddhism? And what do people, I mentioned this the other day when some people were over here. What do people say? Who is your teacher? Okay, people say, my teacher is Bhantagunam Ratana, you know, the famous Sri Lankan monk in the US. My teacher is Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese monk in France. My teacher is Ajahn Sumedho in England. My teacher is Mahasi Sayadaw in Burma. It's you know, Ajahn Shah in Thailand, whatever. And we, Ajahn Brahm, of course, or the one where it's Venerable Jang, or whatever it is, right? Where today is me. But, you know, it's like, these are my, have you ever heard anybody say that Buddha is my teacher? Nobody ever said that, right? And that is very fascinating, because in the end, it's the word of the Buddha, everything goes back to. And yet nobody takes the Buddha as their teacher. And what a shame that is, because these are the best teachings. And precisely, this is the danger, precisely, that the Buddha warned us against here, right? You listen to the disciples, and then, kind of, if you're lucky and you have time to read a verse from the Dhammapada, that's about as far as you go with the teachings of the Buddha. What a shame that is, and we have these wonderful teachings there. And keep that in mind. I'm not saying you shouldn't listen to contemporary teachers or other teachers. I'm not saying you shouldn't listen to those at all. What I'm saying is that there is a hierarchy. That hierarchy, that the teaching of the Buddha should come first, and then should come the teachings of others, right? So there is a clear sequence there. So in the end, your ultimate inspiration should always come from the Buddha. And one of the problems, if you listen too much to teachers that came after the time of the Buddha, contemporary teachers, or even ancient teachers, like, you know, very often, even Theravada Buddhists, instead of reading the suttas, they will read the Visuddhimagga, or they will read the Abhidhamma, or they will read the commentaries, all these kind of things. That is the same thing. All that is also the teaching of the disciples, and not the teachings of the Buddha. So please keep that in mind. And then when you remember that, then you go back to the suttas and you think, wow, this is where my root inspiration goes. And if there is a clash in opinion between different teachers, as there often is, the other night I was having a debate with Stephen Batchelor at Augustine, and that was exactly that, was a clash of opinion, right? He said that rebirth is not so important, I say it is very important. And then there was a disagreement. Okay, so what do? You have to go back to the suttas. And I recommend you to go back to the suttas to find the solution to these kind of problems. Because many problems can be resolved quite easily in that way. Okay, so that is, so all of this then, when you get things the wrong way around and you listen to the wrong teachings, that leads to the decline of the Dhamma, right? It's a future peril. So remember that. So for all of us here, if you want to uphold the Dhamma, we have to know where to go to get our inspiration. It's even more important for us monastics, because we are perhaps even closer to the Dhamma than most lay people. But I think it's important for all of us to remember that. Otherwise, we are part of the thing which drags the Dhamma down if we go to the wrong place. We want to uphold it. We want to build this beautiful teaching. We want everybody to have a chance, now and in the future, be able to read these things, so that everybody can be inspired, have a better life, less conflict, more harmony, more happiness inside, less suffering, more compassion, more peace in our lives. This is the potential of the Dhamma. Let's uphold it so it lasts for a long time into the future. And then the Buddha says, of course, yeah, then it says that then because of the defilement of the Dhamma comes the defilement of the discipline. And from the defilement of the discipline comes the defilement of the Dhamma. And this is how things go down. So the word for discipline here in the Pali is actually the word Vinaya. And the Vinaya is often understood to be the Vinaya Pitaka, you know, which has all the rules for the monastics and things. But in the sutta, the Vinaya means more like the training. So the Dhamma is the theory, is the teaching, and the Vinaya is like the practical aspect of how you train yourself. So if the Dhamma gets corrupted, you can't train yourself properly, right? And if you don't train yourself, we don't realize the Dhamma. So because you don't realize the Dhamma gets corrupted. So two are linked to each other, training and Dhamma being corrupted together. Okay, that's the first sutta. So, wow, that takes... okay, so, and this, I think, is basically the most important one that I want to read out today, simply because it is, for me, very foundational for understanding how Buddhism actually works. So, let's have a look at another one. And this is called the decline of the good Dharma. So it's in the same kind of vein. And what the things that lead to the decline of the good Dharma. Because there are these five things that lead to the decline and disappearance of the good Dharma. Good Dharma, basically the teaching of the Buddha, right? What five? Here, monks, here, the monks do not learn the Dhamma, the discourses, and all the other types of Dhamma that the Buddha has spoken. And this is the first thing that leads to the decline and disappearance of the good Dhamma. Again, the bhikkhus do not teach the Dhamma to others in detail as they have learnt it and heard it. This is the second thing that leads to the decline and disappearance of the good Dhamma. And the fifth one, I'll skip a couple. The bhikkhus do not ponder, examine, and mentally inspect the Dhamma as they have heard it and learnt it. This is the fifth thing that leads to the decline and disappearance of the good Dhamma. So here again you can see this idea that you have to actually read the discourses, right? If you don't read them, it leads to the decline. Here it's explicitly stated that. So you have to read these things. And when you read them, that's when you're upholding these teachings. The second one, interesting, you have to teach it to others, right? So, and this is one of the things that I was saying also during the debate on Friday with Stephen Batchelor, is that it is your duty as a Dhamma teacher to actually teach the teachings of the Buddha. And you have to be very careful so you don't actually misrepresent what the Buddha said. If you, you're presenting yourself as a disciple of the Buddha. And if you're presenting yourself as a disciple of the Buddha, it means that you are drawing on that power of the Buddha. The reason why people respect me as a Buddhist monk is not because I wear funny clothes and shave my head, right? That's not the reason. The reason is because this is a part of a long tradition that goes all the way back to the Buddha. So I'm, in a sense, relying on the Buddha for my livelihood and for my existence and for who I am. And because I rely on the Buddha in that way, it is my duty and obligation in return to teach the word of the Buddha. If not, I'm a fraud, right? It is completely wrong. And this was one of my arguments, and it's the same also for Stephen Batchelor to some degree as well, because he also calls himself a Buddhist. And if you call yourself a Buddhist, you're part of that lineage, and you have a duty to actually teach the word of the Buddha as it actually is. And this is what the Buddha is saying here. If you want the Dhamma to last a long time, we should teach that Dhamma, that word of the Buddha. That's what actually we should be doing. And of course, that's true for lay people as well. I often say it is not just the monks that can teach Dhamma. Sometimes lay people can teach Dhamma. Not only can lay people teach Dhamma, but they can teach Dhamma to monks, right? I'm just telling the story also yesterday for the people who came for Dhamma yesterday. There's a nice story in the suttas of the layman Chitta. And Chitta was very famous, being very highly attained. He had a bag of the five lower fetters. He was a non-returner. He had all the jhanas and all these kind of things. And in one of the suttas with Chitta, the householder, Chitta says, when I go and visit the monastery and the monks, and I bring food to the monks, after the meal, I sit down and listen to the Dhamma. And if the monks don't teach them the Dhamma, then I teach the Dhamma to the monks. Isn't that nice? Because the point is not that we have to have people kind of certain authority figures. The point is that whatever the Dhamma is, whoever knows the Dhamma, they should be put in a teacher position so that we all can learn from that. We don't need this kind of hierarchies all the time. So the point here is to get the Dhamma out there. That's what this is all about. And I must say that one of the great things about sitting in this position, whether you think that, you know, maybe you think I'm doing you a service by sitting here, or maybe you think, I don't know what you think, but what I think is that thank you for being here, because it gives me a chance to teach the Dhamma. Whenever I teach the Dhamma, I get inspired, right? I learn more about these teachings. It's wonderful for me to actually have an audience that's interested in these things, because it means that we can both benefit from this. Teaching is very powerful. And I remember even Ajahn Chah said that apparently, about teaching is a wonderful way of learning the Dhamma, because you have to know what you're talking about. You have to think about it. You have to reflect on it. You can't get away from that when you are in a teaching position. And then the last one here is again that you have to ponder, examine, and mentally inspect the Dhamma as you have heard it and learned it. And this is, again, is obviously very important for monastics. It's also very important for lay people that the Dhamma is profound, the Dhamma is deep, but often it's a very different viewpoint from what we normally have. And because it's a different viewpoint, it often takes a while for this thing to sink in and become your own, and you can understand them properly, right? It's not easy always. It's not hard either, but it's a different viewpoint, different way of looking at things. And when things are different from what we are used to, either we struggle to understand them better, or we are even defensive. We say, this can't possibly be true, this doesn't make any sense at all, right? And it often takes a while to be able to appreciate these teachings. And sometimes we can't appreciate them, which is fine, in which case we leave them behind. But other times, it's just like a maturing process. You learn to appreciate these beautiful teachings. So you have to reflect, you have to think about these things. This is a very important part of the Dhamma practice. There is a place in the Anguttara Nikaya where the Buddha talks about three different kinds of wisdom. And one kind of wisdom is what he calls the lap wisdom. Right? Lap wisdom sounds a bit strange. That's what he called it. And the reason he calls it that is because it's like you're sitting down like now and you have all these gems and jewels and things in your lap, right? And the gems and the jewels, they are like the Dhamma. So you sit down and then when you rise up, all these gems and jewels are spread everywhere because you don't look after it properly and put it together or whatever. And it's the same thing with many people. The people who have lap wisdom are the people who come and they hear a Dhamma talk or they read a sutta. And as soon as they have read it and heard it, they kind of get up and they forget about it straight away, right? That's the lap wisdom. That is not very good wisdom, lap wisdom. The point is that it's not much wisdom at all. That's the point, right? So please examine this, and this is one of the great benefits of going on a meditation retreat sometimes, or being quiet sometimes, just being reflective, but particularly meditation retreats. Meditation retreats are not just about sitting down and kind of trying to get into meditation. Often it's also a wonderful opportunity to learn more about the Dhamma and reflect on it. And you find that if you do reflect on the Dhamma and you think about it in the right way, it becomes a beautiful support for meditation practice. Because Dhamma is something that makes you peaceful when you think about it in the right way. It's something that calms you down, and the two go together. And then, when you then meditate, and meditation becomes more deeper, then suddenly the teachings start to make more sense as well, right? So two things going together, building on each other. And what a wonderful thing that is. So please, occasionally, as lay people as well, do take time out sometimes. You could go on a retreat to be by yourself, to reflect on the Dhamma, to find more peace in life, and you will find it very, very nourishing for your Buddhist practice. Okay, so remember that if we don't ponder the Dhamma, again, it leads to decline in the Dhamma. So this is one of the things that we need to do, not to have decline in this teaching. Okay, so that is kind of the background sutra. The background sutra took most of the time, but never mind. That's just the way things go sometimes. And now I wanted to have a look at a few sutras, or at least one or two, about the life of the Buddha. These are about the Buddha himself, how he acted and what he was like. And the reason why I like often to read about the Buddha himself is because I find it very inspiring here. Now, I would like to talk a little bit about what it means to read about the Buddha. Because the first thing which always strikes me, why does the Buddha talk about his own life in the first place, right? Now, the one reason you find it very quickly, it's not because he wants to tell you his life story. It's not because he wants to say, this is what happened to me, that's what happened to me. Because the information in there is very scant, and there isn't much information about the Buddha. And it certainly doesn't have an historical point of view either, because there's no kind of connected history or anything like that. That's not why the Buddha talks about his life. The reason why the Buddha talks about his life is because he wants to inspire us. He wants to show that this is the way he practiced, so you should be practicing in the same way. You should be doing. You should be following my example. He's setting up himself as an example. You should be practicing the same thing. Now, this is important, right? Sometimes we think that the Buddha is like so high, and he's kind of so wise, and he's so different from us, and you have to be careful with that kind of thing. You have to be careful not to put the Buddha on too high a pedestal. If you put him too high up, and you start worshipping the Buddha like a god, and you lose your connection to the Buddha. We cannot practice like a god, right? You cannot practice like something you are not. We have to practice like a human being here. So when you understand that the Buddha is a human being just like us, then his life becomes meaningful to us. So it's important to understand that the Buddha is high, but not too high. He is human. He has the same, his problems are the same problems that he faced, that we are facing today, the problems of suffering in life. The genius of the Buddha is that he found a solution to that. But in essence, he is basically the same as us. He's a human being. And because he's a human being just like us, it means that we can follow his example. There is no absolute distinction between the Buddha and anyone else in this world. So please keep that in mind, so we don't kind of go down the road. There's too much in the world where people worship the Buddha as a god or as some kind of being which is completely inaccessible to ordinary humans. And to me that destroys so much of the beauty of the Dhamma. It destroys precisely the reason why the Buddha taught his life stories in the first place. It's to inspire us, not to just to be in awe and think, wow, I can't do that, okay, I'm just going to pray to you, whatever. And then we lose the feeling of Buddhism. So let me read one of these little stories from the suttas. It's probably very likely to be something you have never heard before, because I have taken things from places where quite possibly you haven't read. Even if you do read the suttas, you probably haven't read this before. So this is one of those little stories which I find very beautiful, and it says quite a few things about the Buddha himself. This is taken from the Vinaya Pitaka. Now, at that time, a certain bhikkhu was sick with dysentery. Dysentery is like diarrhea, that sort of thing. He lay foul in his own urine and excrement. Then the Blessed One, walking on inspection tour of the lodgings with Venerable Ananda as his attendant, went to that bhikkhu's dwelling, and on arrival saw the bhikkhu lying foul in his own urine and excrement. On seeing him, he went to the bhikkhu and said, "What is your illness, bhikkhu?" "I have dysentery, Bhante." "But do you have an attendant?" "No, Bhante." "Then why don't the bhikkhus tend to you?" "I don't do anything for the bhikkhus, which is why they don't tend to me." Then the Blessed One addressed Venerable Ananda, "Go fetch some water, Ananda. We will wash this bhikkhu." "As you say, Venerable Sir," said Venerable Ananda, and he fetched some water. The Blessed One sprinkled the water on the bhikkhu, and Venerable Ananda washed him off. Then, with the Blessed One taking the bhikkhu by the head, and the Venerable Ananda taking him by the feet, they lifted him up and placed him on a bed. Then the Blessed One had the bhikkhus assembled, in other words, all the bhikkhus around there assembled, and asked them, "Is there a sick bhikkhu in that dwelling over there?" "Yes, Bhante, there is." "And what is his illness?" "He has dysentery, Bhante." "But does he have an attendant?" "No, Bhante." "Then why don't the bhikkhus tend to him?" "He doesn't do anything for the bhikkhus, Bhante, which is why they don't tend to him." "Bhikkhus," says the Buddha, "you have no mother, you have no father who might tend to you. If you don't tend to each other, who then will tend to you? Whoever would tend to me should also be tending to the sick." Okay, so there you are. So that is, I think it's a very beautiful little story about the Buddha and what the Buddha was like. And you can see here how human it is, right? The Buddha sees a monk who is very sick and who is completely incapable of looking after himself properly. And the Buddha, together with Venerable Ananda, go and help him, wash him down, clean him up, put him on a bed so he can rest, right? But what a wonderful thing that is, that the Buddha does this kind of thing. So you see, the Buddha here is not some kind of divine being which is above all human things. He takes part in the problems of the world, takes part in the human actions. And he acts out of compassion, right? He sees someone who is sick. He does all those things that we should be doing. The Buddha is doing the same things. So he's acting out of compassion. And he's also, of course, one of the things that the Buddha is doing here. He's showing us the example of what we should also be like. And the Buddha, although the Buddha is the leader of the community, although he is, you know, way above everyone else, everybody would be looking to the Buddha as a teacher, He is not kind of, he's not above helping somebody out who is below himself, one of his own disciples. What a wonderful example that is. I often think that one of the qualities of a truly civilized society is how we treat the poorest and the most kind of disadvantaged people in our society. If we treat the poorest and the most disadvantaged people well, then that is a sign of a truly civilized society. Sometimes, you know, when I go to, some of the Asian countries, are very common in some Asian countries like Singapore and Malaysia and many other places to have maids and that sort of thing. And often these maids are completely defenseless, right? They are kind of taken, imported, so to speak, quite literally imported from Indonesia or from somewhere far away. And they are completely defenseless. They have nothing they can say. Often they are treated really badly. But that is not the Buddhist way. If you have a maid, if you have somebody who's lower on the social hierarchy than you, somebody who's very vulnerable because they have nothing, nowhere to go, nothing they can do, how you treat them, to me, is a degree of your civilizedness as a human being, your degree of understanding of the Buddha's teachings. We treat everyone well. We don't treat them well because we are afraid. If you treat somebody higher up than you well, usually because you have a bit of fear of the consequence if you don't do so. But when you treat someone lower down than you well, it means you're doing so purely out of compassion. It's coming from your heart because you know this is a human being. They hurt inside if you don't treat them well, right? But, so you give them that compassion instead. And this is here, it's the Buddha giving us the example. And when the Buddha gives us the example, wow, it makes it so much easier to follow that and practice in the same way ourselves. I doubt that many of you will have heard this teaching before, but I found it very beautiful and very powerful and a very striking example on how we should all be and how we should all act towards each other with compassion and kindness. And it shows you the humanity of the Buddha, right? He was very much part of that group of human beings at that time. Okay, so let me move on to the next one. This is sutta is called Pavarana, and Pavarana in Pali means invitation, and this is coming from the Sanghita Nikaya, and it goes as follows. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Samadhi in the eastern park in the mansion of Migara's mother, together with a great sangha of bhikkhus, with 500 bhikkhus, all of them arahants. Now on that occasion, the Upasaka day of the 15th, the Blessed One was sitting in the open, surrounded by the Bhikkhu Sangha, in order to hold the Pavarana. Then, having surveyed the silent Bhikkhu Sangha, the Blessed One addressed the Bhikkhus thus, "Come, Bhikkhus, let me invite you. Is there any deed of mine, either bodily or verbal, which you would censure?" Censure me by criticizing, or blame, or whatever. When this was said, the Venerable Sariputta rose from his seat, arranged his upper robe over one shoulder, and raising his joined hand in reverential salutation, Anjali, right, towards the Blessed One, said to him, "Venerable Sir, there is no deed of the Blessed One, either bodily or verbal, that we censure. For, Venerable Sir, the Blessed One is the originator of the path, unarisen before, the producer of the path, unproduced before, the declarer of the path, undeclared before. He is the knower of the path, the discoverer of the path, the one skilled in the path. And his disciples now dwell following that path and become possessors of it afterwards." So, again, it's a beautiful, shows you beautifully how the Buddha is an example to us all. This idea of Pavarana is one of the things that we do as monastics. As monastics, we have a day every year called the Pavarana Day after the rains retreat when we invite each other in precisely this way. We say, "Please, if there's anything that I have said or done, can please let me know so I can kind of correct my ways and change what I've been doing." And it's a beautiful occasion to be able to do that. Usually, we tend to go around criticizing others, right? It's kind of the human condition. We criticize other people. But when someone criticizes us, we get usually very upset. there's kind of it's a slight imbalance there, right? It's okay to criticize others, but if someone criticizes us, then it's not good anymore. There's something not quite right about that when you think about it. So this Pavarana thing is turning things upside down. Instead of criticizing others, you're inviting other people to criticize you, right? Please, what have I done? Please let me know. What a wonderful thing that is. It shows you how sincere you are about changing yourself, about changing your habits and becoming a better human. When you actually invite other people's criticism, you're turning the whole thing upside down in a sense. And of course, if somebody does that to you, if somebody does give you that invitation, it's important that you don't abuse that, right? And say, yeah, now I'm really going to tell you off, right? If you think like that, then it's terrible. That's not what you have to do. You have to take responsibility and only say anything if there really is something very important that needs to be said. Usually you don't say anything at all because you realize that just the beauty of someone opening themselves up for admonition is already so powerful and beautiful that you don't really have to say anything at that point. But if it is necessary, at that point you can say something. And how does the Buddha say that we should react to other people criticizing us? And that is found in the Brahmajala Sutta. The Brahmajala Sutta it begins off with the Buddha wandering around the countryside. After the Bhikkhu Sangha, he often had a large Sangha of Bhikkhus coming after him, perhaps Bhikkhunis as well, I'm not sure about that, because they're not usually mentioned. There may well have been Bhikkhunis there as well. But anyway, and after all the Sangha members, there were these two Brahmins walking behind the Sangha. And one of the Brahmins was praising Buddha, saying, wow, what a wonderful teaching this Buddhism is. The other one was criticizing, it's terrible teaching. You know, we should be proper Brahmins, shouldn't kind of go over to Buddhism or whatever. And then the monks mention this, and the Buddha then explains to them how they should deal with criticism in life. And very powerful thing to remember this, how we should deal with criticism and praise. When you're criticized or praised, you should ask yourself the very simple question, is it true? Is it right, what I'm hearing? And if the praise is right, well then okay, it's right. If the praise is wrong, you should kind of can't have some kind of glory in the praise. Wow, now I'm praised, it's wonderful. If it is not right, you should dismiss it as that. It's not actually correct. If your criticism is wrong, it's exactly the same thing. You ask yourself, is there something to this? And if there is something to it, then you should treat it as if somebody pointing out a treasure to you. This is what it says in the Dhammapada. If somebody points out a fault to you, it's like somebody pointing out a treasure. Right? It doesn't sound like a treasure, or something like that. It sounds like something terrible. We don't want to hear about our faults. But it is a treasure, because sometimes we are blind to our own faults. Sometimes we can't see ourselves clearly. Sometimes other people can see us better. Because our faults are so habitual, so ingrained, it's very difficult for us to sometimes see them. So if somebody points it out, we should step back and think, wait a minute, is that true? Do they have a point? Instead of getting upset and angry, this is how we should react. And if we then discover that they may have at least a little bit of a point, then we have an opportunity. We have a chance to change ourselves, which otherwise we may not have had, right? That is why it is pointing out the treasure. And then when you are able to change yourself, when you are able to get rid of your defilements and grow in the Dhamma, it means you become a more happy person. You become more contented. You become have a better life. And because of that, it's like a treasure. Just like a big treasure of money will make you happy. Maybe it will, maybe it won't, but I think that's the idea. This will also make you more happy as a person. Wonderful little thing. Pointing out the fault is like pointing out a treasure. And this is what we do then when somebody criticizes us. We reflect. Maybe there's a point there. Or they get it completely wrong and we can say, okay, forget about it. They're just deluded. They don't understand what they're talking about. I don't have to worry about that. So that is the way to reacting to criticism and praise in the right way. Reflect on it. Don't just dismiss it out of hand. Of course, a lot of the time you will find that people, when they criticize us, they are angry and upset and they're coming from the wrong place. So a lot of the time you can just dismiss it straight away because you know it's not the right thing. But occasionally somebody will say something that is useful and then we should take it on board and becomes very powerful for us if we do that. So, and this is what the Buddha shows us here. He, the Buddha himself, invites his monks to criticize him, right? It's an example for us, but I think it is also an honest thing to do, even for the Buddha sometimes. Maybe he makes a mistake. And there are a few cases in the suttas where even the Buddha, obviously not coming from defilement, it's not coming from a bad thing or anything like that. But sometimes it may be that the consequences of something he has done may not, you know, he may not have seen those straight away. And there are a couple of stories in the Vinaya which I think make that point in a sense. So even the Buddha is saying, well, if there's anything, you know, I'm willing to listen to you. I don't think he said it just to make me an example. I think he probably means it, otherwise it wouldn't be there. Okay, that is something good to think about. So, the last thing then that Venerable Sariputta says is that the Buddha is the originator of the path, unproduced before, declared of the path, undeclared before, the knower of the path, the discoverer of the path. And this is what makes a Buddha a Buddha. And this is what makes him different from the rest of us, that he started this whole thing. He was able to kind of find his way into this mass of darkness and ignorance and delusion and all these other things and actually discover the truth. That is what the Buddha did. And that is amazing enough. Sometimes people want to make more out of the Buddha. But wow, how incredible it is that it's possible by yourself, without anybody else to teach you, to find your way through this very difficult thing. And we all know how difficult it is. We are all disciples of the Buddha. We are practicing to the best of our ability. And are we all awakened yet? How many people in here who actually are awakened already? This is the thing, right? We are disciples. We've got the path laid out for us. Do this. And still we can't do it. And he was able to find his own way through this. That's pretty powerful stuff, right? And that's really enough to gain my respect in a very, very profound way. He obviously was someone very wise and very powerful there. And this is so this is what comes out of this particular thing. Okay, I had a couple of more suttas I thought I was going to read out, but perhaps we're running out of time a little bit. I can do this next time I come to Melbourne, and maybe in, I don't know, 10 years' time? Whatever, let's see what happens. But I think we have a bit more time than that. How long can we keep going?
You will have Q&A.
Yeah, can I have? Or I can. How long can we keep going? To 11 o'clock, is that right?
1 o'clock?
1 o'clock, yeah. No, I'm not going to keep going to 1 o'clock. That's another question. Does anyone have any questions they want to, or anything they want to raise? Any comments? Any complaints? I give you Pavarana to complain. Everybody there? Everybody? I'm totally happy with everything I said then. Nothing there. Controversial? That's terrible. You always say something controversial to make people think, you know. You want to hear a bit more?
Yeah?
Everybody want to hear a bit more? Yeah? Okay. Okay. If you don't want to hear, if you had enough, then you're always welcome to leave. There's no obligation to sit there all the time. Sometimes in traditional Buddhism, it's considered impolite to leave during a Dhamma talk. But sometimes there is a good reason, and it's perfectly okay to go. Okay, so let's do one more sutta. This is called the Bakkali Sutta. And this is about how to relate to the Buddha, how we should relate to the Buddha in general. And this is about a monk who was very, very ill, and he was about to die at that point, and he wants to see the Buddha, and then the Buddha comes to see him. So the Buddha sits down, and then he says to Venerable Bakkali, I hope you are bearing up, Bakkali. I hope you are getting better, and I hope that your painful feelings are subsiding and not increasing, and that the subsiding, not the increase, is to be discerned. Venerable sir, I am not bearing up. I am not getting better. Strong, painful feelings are increasing in me, not subsiding, and their increase, not subsiding, is to be discerned. I hope then, Bakkali, that you are not troubled by remorse and regret. Indeed, venerable sir, I have quite a lot of remorse and regret. I hope, Bakkali, that you have nothing for which to reproach yourself in regard to virtue. I have nothing, venerable sir, for which to reproach myself in regard to virtue. Then, Bakkali, if you have nothing for which to reproach yourself in regard to virtue, Why are you troubled by remorse and regret? For a long time, venerable sir, I have wanted to come to see the Blessed One, but I haven't been fit enough to do so. Then the Buddha replies, enough, Vakali. Why do you want to see this foul body? The one who sees the Dhamma sees me. The one who sees me sees the Dhamma. For one sees the Dhamma, Vakali, sees me, and in seeing me, one sees the Dhamma. So, this to me is a very nice sutta to remind us again what is important in Buddhism. It is very easy to become focused on the Buddha as a physical object, like a person, right? And you see that in the world today, there's a lot of worship of things like Buddha relics around the world, right? Buddha relics are considered so important, everybody bows down to the Buddha relics. And it's not just, it's everywhere in the Buddhist world. The whole Buddhist world is packed with this. But of course, perhaps the epitome of that you find in Sri Lanka, because Sri Lanka has one of the most precious of all the Buddha relics, the relic of the twos, right, in Kandy. And it becomes like an object of worship. And this is where we often go wrong as Buddhists. We need to remember what Buddhism really is about. It's not about worshipping the body of the Buddha. It's about understanding the Dhamma. This is what it comes to. And the problem with it is that so often it does, unfortunately, lead to superstition. It leads to problems. It is, of course, true that you can bow down to the relics or a Buddha statue in a good way. And a good way of doing that is to say, what I'm bowing down to is the qualities that the Buddha, the Buddha is all about. If you do it that way, it's okay. There's a tendency for these things to move from that idea and move towards kind of worshipping the relics in their own right. And the problem with the tooth in the relic or the tooth in the can is not even a human tooth. I've heard people see this tooth and they say, it's really big, a tooth. It's nothing to do with humans. And of course then when people explain, well, the reason why it's so big is because the Buddha was 3 times the size of an ordinary human, right? Was he 3 times the size of an ordinary human? That's what it says in the commentaries. So if you believe that, then you will believe. But it doesn't make any sense. No human is 3 times the size of others. And in fact, it's very clear from the suttas themselves that the Buddha was ordinary size. He would exchange his robes with other monks. When people saw him, they weren't able to tell him from other monks. All these things show you that he was an ordinary monk. So the thing that is being worshipped in the temple of the tooth is probably just the tooth of something else. Maybe some animal or something. I don't know where it came from. But it's very clearly not the temple tooth of the Buddha, right? And this is how kind of superstition tends to creep into things. We tend to believe that things are relics. And maybe some of these relics are Buddha relics. I don't actually know. I have no idea. But one of the things that I have noticed in the world is that if you add up all the relics in the whole world that come together, you will get this mountain of relics. There are so many. Every temple will have the little relics, right? And the Buddha couldn't possibly have been that large. So, again, it makes a little bit skeptical of these things. So it's important to remember that what we want to do, and the Buddha says, why on earth do you want to worship this body? That's not what it's about. It's about the Dhamma. It's about what the Buddha represents. So even when we come here and we see the Buddha statue here, remember, you're not worshipping the Buddha statue. The Buddha statue represents something. And what it represents is the qualities of the Buddha. What we're worshipping is those qualities. What makes a Buddha is not the physical body. What makes a Buddha is the qualities in the heart of that person. And the qualities in the heart of a Buddha is purity, lack of defilements, wisdom, understanding, compassion, peace. All of these things, that is what the Buddha is. And that is what we should be worshipping, right? What a wonderful thing it is to bow down to these qualities. I don't know, for me it is very easy to bow down to these things because I know that these things are beautiful things. And I'm sure you will all agree with that. These things are truly worthy of bowing down to her. So remember that. We need to sometimes remind ourselves. It's so easy to kind of drift into just a little bit of superstition, right? And just worship these relics as if they are something special. That's the wrong way. And the Buddha says so right here. Right? The right way is to do things. That's not Dhamma. You understand the Buddha, to understand the qualities of the Buddha, when you see them inside of yourself, that is when you understand the Buddha. You don't understand the Buddha by seeing a Buddha statue, by seeing a relic, or even by seeing the Buddha in person. Right? Actually, to see the Buddha in person can actually probably be very inspiring. Right? Because when you see the Buddha first, you're also seeing a little bit of the qualities of the heart of that person, right? It's like when you see a monk who is, or a nun, or a lay person who is very developed on the spiritual path, then it has a powerful effect on you, because you're seeing something beautiful there. It says in the Sutta that just seeing an arahant in the world is a great benefit. Because when you see an arahant, you're seeing something that's very, very special. And you can, the mind flows out into the actions of the body. The actions will be peaceful. The way they speak will be wise. They won't be saying very much, right? That shows I'm not married, I speak way too much. And it's all like that. So you can see the beautiful mental state inside by just observing that. And that, the Buddha, is already a wonderful thing in the world. So let's get more arahants in the world. That's what I say. So we all need to practice very hard for that. So that is the Vakkali Sutta, about relating to the Buddha in the right way. And the last sutta for today that I'm going to read out for you is called the Gotamaka Sutta. And this is a very short teaching. And this is the Buddha trying to inspire his disciples. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Vesali, at the Gotamaka Shrine. There the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus. Bhikkhus, I teach the Dhamma through direct knowledge, not without direct knowledge. I teach the Dhamma with a foundation, not without a foundation. I teach the Dhamma that is wonderful, not one without wonders. Since I teach the Dhamma through direct knowledge, not without direct knowledge, is a teach one with a foundation, not without a foundation. Is a teach a Dhamma that is wonderful, not without wonders. My exhortation should be acted upon. My instructions should be acted upon. It is enough for you to rejoice, enough for you to be elated, enough for you to be joyful. The Blessed One is perfectly enlightened. The Dhamma is well expounded by the Blessed One. The Sangha is practicing the good path. So this is the Buddha reminding us that it is not, these are not theoretical teachings. These are teachings that he has seen directly for himself, right? And because he has seen it directly for himself, there is an understanding there. When he teaches the Dhamma, that Dhamma has a basis. It has a foundation in truth. It doesn't just have a foundation in theory. And because the Dhamma has a foundation in truth, not just in theory, it is wonderful. This word is often translated as miraculous. The Pali word is, how does this Pali word go again? This is a difficult Pali word. Patihara, yeah. Which means like miracles in or yeah. It doesn't actually mean miracle, because miracles is a Christian word. But it means a wonders, a marvel, something which is amazing. And the marvel of Buddhism, remember that, the marvel of Buddhism, when you're talking about the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, the marvel of Buddhism is the very fact that when you teach the Dhamma, other people are able to practice accordingly and achieve the same results. That is the marvel of Buddhism. It's called the Anusasana Patiharana, and it means the marvel or the wonder of instruction, that other people can gain the same thing. After his awakening, the Buddha thought, maybe nobody will understand what I teach, right? Maybe it's too profound. And then he discovered that people actually can understand these teachings. And as long as you apply yourself, as long as you move in that direction, you too, everyone here, can become the ear of these beautiful teachings. That is the marvel of the Dhamma, that it can actually give rise to the same thing. So, isn't that wonderful? We have a teaching, which is a teaching that is based on true insight. And those teachings work for every one of us. All we have to do is put them into practice, and then they will work. And the Buddha said, it is enough for you to be joyful, right? You've got these wonderful teachings. It's enough for you to be energetic. Put them into practice. And then we will all reap the benefits of these wonderful teachings. Okay, so That is all I want to say here today. Yeah. Have you all of any questions you'd like to ask in the meantime? Are you all there? Yes, sir.
Thank you. Yes. I refer to the debate last Friday.
Oh, yeah, you were there?
Yes,
yeah.
Yes, right.
Yeah.
Two methods.
Yeah.
One was Stephen Batchelor.
Yeah.
Correct me if I'm wrong. A view that craving, tanha, was more important than rebirth. That brought me to the question was, independent origination, there are 12 factors. Are they equally important, or one may be more important than the other?
I don't think we can rank these things in terms of importance. I don't think that's possible. They're all part of the teaching, and they all fit together. The Buddha teaching is a bit like a jigsaw puzzle, right? And everything has a part. Everything fits together with everything else. And we can't really say that one thing is more important than the other. But I think the point here is that we have to remember the Noble Eightfold Path. It begins, the first factor of the Noble Eightfold Path is right view, right? And because the first factor is right view, and because the Noble Eightfold Path is a structured path, one thing leads on to the next one. If you haven't got some right view at the very beginning, it means that the other factors of the path won't take off, and you won't be able to practice properly. So you have to have something with your right view. And the more powerful that right view is, the more powerful the first factor is, the more powerful the whole path becomes. Because it is a conditioned path, that is a path of causality, one thing leading to the next one. So the more right view you have, the more powerful it will be. And for that reason, it actually matters quite a lot. It matters quite a lot that you have the idea of rebirth. To me, is actually a very powerful one, because if you reflect on it rightly, it will actually propel you along this path. That is part of that one. There's more to right view than that, but that is one very important factor of right view.
How did you feel after the debate? My son, 14 and 16 years old, they attended and they discussed. They said to me that, end of the day, I think they said that, I don't think Ajahn Brahmani matter whether he won or not, because it didn't matter. And what did Buddha teach us about debate?
Right, okay. That's a very good point. We should go into this debate with the idea that you're going to win or something. You've already lost, right? That's the problem. You have to go there with the idea, okay, I'm going to try to teach some Dhamma teaching. I'm going to try to have a bit of, let's have a good conversation together and see what happens. And if some good Dhamma comes out of it, it's wonderful. It's not about winning. It's about, what it's about, then teaching the Dhamma. And those who are ready to understand the Dhamma, they will take it on board. And those who don't, are not ready for that because they're doing something else or whatever, they will not take it on board. That's what it's about. So I find it sometimes debate in kind of Western culture is often very antagonistic. You kind of debate with each other, one is supposed to win, one is supposed to lose, which is not so nice. The idea is basically to come to some kind of understanding. If people come to an understanding, then I think you have, that's how you win a debate. People improve their understanding and then move in the right direction. That's how a debate is won, in my opinion.
I'm sorry, we haven't got much time.
Really?
And now we've got an afternoon program, I've been told.
Yeah.
Perhaps one more question.
Sure, of course, yeah, please.
Yes, I think that will have to be it.
Yeah, there's one question at the back there, I think, yeah. There's one hand going up. Yes?
I'm sorry, does that person want to ask a question?
This is the last question.
Okay, it's in relation to the Noble Eightfold Path. I was instructed by some people, some lay people, and when I was investigating the Noble Eightfold Path, that it's all interrelated, you don't have to take one step sequentially. If what you're saying, that we take the first step at the right view, does that mean that they're taken sequentially after that, or do they feed in after that, just interrelationships?
Okay, yep. It is both. It is both sequential and interrelated at the same time. There is a main sequence which starts from right view and goes all the way up to right samadhi, you know, samadhi. And that is the main sequence. That's the most important sequence. So you have to have a little bit of right view even to get started. If you have actually zero right view, if you think that being a complete scallywag immoral is okay, you're never going to get started, right? So this is the problem there. But it also, there's also feedback. So there's a general direction, but that general direction also involves feedback from the higher practice coming back to the first one. So as you practice an noble-eightfold path, you'll find that the later stages actually feed back into the earlier ones, and particularly into right view. So in that case, the whole path develops together. So these things basically, they go together. So there's both sequentiality and feedback group at the same time. Again, to understand these things, I would recommend you to read the suttas, because my information, the reason I teach in this way is because this is the information I get from the suttas. So the Buddha teaches the Noble Eightfold Path, he actually quite literally says that there is a causality between these eight factors and one leading to the other one. That's where I take it from when I say this. And also, you find other places where it shows you the idea of feedback at the same time.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. So,
Pastor Buddha.
Yeah, well, yeah. Okay. Let's pay our respects to the head. For the Buddha, once I go.